Tie him out of a beautiful evening to be here, talk about the future of our nation, which I think is very bright with your help. You've invited me here on a very auspicious occasion. Whether it's by design or not, I don't know. I suspect perhaps it is. But tonight is 19 years since my mom, my dad, my brother, my grandmother, and I came to the United States of America as refugees from the Soviet Union.
It was
October the 8th, 1994, that after a very long flight all the way from Moscow, we landed at the San Francisco airport, not knowing what to expect, coming here with nothing other than a dream of living in freedom and faith in the virtues of the United States of America. And how lucky we are to get to know freedom firsthand and live the American dream. I was only 13 when I came here. My parents persevered and sacrificed a lot. They literally risked their lives to get me and my brother here so that we could spend our lives learning exactly what freedom means to humanity. So I brought them here tonight. I wanted them, before I speak and talk to you a little bit about the state of my campaign and the state of the nation and what I hope to accomplish in Congress and why I hope to earn your support, I wanted to have them come up and say a few words about our journey here and what possessed them to risk everything that they owned and their lives and their friends and relatives to come into a brand new country just to learn what freedom's all about. So please give them a warm welcome. They'll come and say a few words.
Good evening. My name is Alex Berman. I'm the father. And today is exactly the first event of 19 years since that day when our family arrived in San Francisco Airport, direct from Moscow. We celebrate this day every year. So this is our family's home. That was our first trip abroad because during all our lives we were living under the Iron Curtain. We didn't have government permission to leave the country, even for a short time. For us and for our kids, this transition was like a miracle. And we are so grateful to American people giving us that chance when Soviet Union collapsed. Our main goal was to give our kids the opportunity to live in free society when all ways are open for them. So our dream came true. Now, our youngest son, Eugene, is an established composer, working with prestigious orchestras and choirs all over the world. But ego is superior. After
I'll remind my brother when he gets back.
After getting great experience working with Oswald McClintock, he's now running for his own seat in his conference. For us, his family, this is a great honor to be here today and feel your support in this endeavor. Igor is a brilliant son, and we are completely aware he will represent people of the district with dignity. He knows firsthand what socialism means for people, how terrible the broken health care system is, and he'll do whatever he can to prevent America from slipping into socialist society like Soviet Union. Thank you for inviting us today. We greatly appreciate your support, and we are completely sure with your support, Igor wins this election. Thank you.
I can just maybe add just a few brief examples. What we came through and what maybe now it reminds me where this country is going. And I'm really, really scared. When we lived in the Soviet Union, for example, I can say just a few words about the health care system that the country is now embraces with this new health care law. In the Soviet Union, if someone wanted to see a doctor, there was a huge line in the it was like, you know, Moscow was divided into districts. And every person who lived in the district should go just directly to the healthcare, you know, just outpatient clinic where he lived, nowhere else. He couldn't choose a doctor. He couldn't choose, you know, anything. Just go to a particular outpatient clinic. And there you will stay in line to get, like, a ticket to see a doctor. And maybe this ticket will allow you to see a doctor in 3 weeks or maybe in, I don't know. It's a long, it was a long, long line. And now this, I don't know this law. I couldn't read it. It's enormous. I don't know who read it. But it's scary. Especially with this death panels. I don't know if they are still there in this law or they removed them. It's not the country we were even, you know, thinking before we left the Soviet Union and came here. It was a different country 19 years ago to me, and probably to you even more than to us. But we can feel it. Or with this, you know, this revelations that that guy Snowden showed us, it's also very interesting, you know, to us, because we were under KGB surveillance for a long time before we left. When they found out that we are going to leave, Alex was a well-known physicist there in the Soviet Union, and he continues working as a physicist here. But since he had some high level of security, we couldn't leave, you know, as soon as we wanted. So we were waiting for a long time before we left, and there was. And KGB was so much interested in us, so they ransacked our apartment before we left. It was terrible. We went to say goodbye to my brother and his family, who still they still live in St. Petersburg, a beautiful city in Russia. So when we came back, it was just the apartment turned upside down. They were looking for everything. They were following Alex. They were, you know. It was a very terrible experience. So when Snowden opened our eyes a little bit, it looks like government is also watching us. So
yeah.
it's not where this country should go. So we came here to embrace freedom, and we wanted our kids to live in freedom, and we never wanted them to know what these limitations are. So we were sure that this country will never sleep in that terrible situation, will become that terrible society where we came from. So we hope it will be same beautiful country where we were sure we're going to live in, and we're happy and very, very glad to be American citizens after 10 years in this country. What, 5 years. We became American citizens. And our Alex's mother and my parents became American citizens when they were in a very advanced age already. After they were over 80, they learned English to take this citizenship exam, and I hope it will be forever the country where people will become citizens coming here legally. This is our hope. So we hope that Igor, who came through this experience, though he was 13, but he was very smart, he knew where he, and he knows where he came from. So he knows what it is. He experienced it firsthand. So we hope he will fight for this country to be the beautiful country as it was found in the beginning of the year. So, good luck, Sam.
Well, folks, these are my heroes, truly. know, you can tell that to them, freedom is very personal because they invested a lot into it and they put up with a lot for it. You know, when you're 13, going to America is an adventure. You get to go on an airplane the very first time in your life. You get to go to a new place and make new friends and go to school. It's an adventure. And to my parents, it was something else. You know, they left behind a society that surveilled their every move, that made decisions over every most minute aspect of their lives, that harassed them, that threatened them. But also they left behind the warmth and comfort of home, the only home that we'd ever known. They left behind friends and relatives, some of whom they weren't ever going to see again. And they did all that because they believed in freedom. You know, when the American people, when the American embassy told us to come and come right away after our apartment had gotten searched, lest the Russian government change its mind, we packed up our things and left. Traveling here solely on faith that freedom works. And we know instinctively that it does. So, you know, one of the most frequently asked questions I get is, how difficult was the decision to run for Congress? It must be monumental. You know the answer I give? I say, maybe so, but it pales in comparison to how monumental the decision was for my parents to risk their lives, risk all of their meager possessions, risk everything that they'd accomplished, risk ultimately the success of their children, to embark on a new life in a new land. And when we got here, we prospered. You know, my dad, as my mom said, is a physicist. We came here in October of 94. We didn't have much. We didn't have friends. We didn't have relatives. We didn't have, you know, jobs. We were on food stamps for a few months. But my parents wanted jobs, not food stamps. By early 1995, within about 3 months, my dad had a job. He had a full-time job, a really good job as a physicist. In fact, he became one of the lead scientists at a fiber optics company where he first found employment. Because of his help, you know, we watched the miracle of freedom at work as that company expanded from just a few employees to just about 1,000. Huge growth. And that's testament to freedom, because once you put your talents to use and you persevere, sky's the limit in a free society. So, having watched all that, having watched the fruits of personal responsibility, having watched the plethora and the abundance that freedom produces in a constitutionally limited government, how could I not then devote my life to preserving those same freedoms to those who are yet to come? And especially at a time when every single aspect of freedom is seemingly threatened by our own leaders. And don't forget, these aren't leaders that came to power by, you know, a criminal act like those leaders when we fled in the Soviet Union. These are folks whom the American people elected, and one other thing, who raised their right hand and swore to preserve and protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. And instead, they're traducing and betraying every single principle that makes freedom possible. We're seeing it all around us. We're seeing it all around us to the point where it's no longer a theoretical discussion. You know, for decades, Republicans would fight with Democrats, liberals would fight with conservatives over theory. Well, raise taxes or lower taxes? Well, are we going to bring in more revenue or less? You know, impose a new mandate. Will it be better for the people or worse? Lots and lots of very acrimonious academic conversations. Well, to me, they're personal because I've lived their ultimate extent. And now they're becoming personal to all of us, because we're seeing their results all around us. We're seeing families, you know, families perhaps like mine, new immigrants, who, unlike my dad, can't find a full-time job with benefits. Not because the American spirit of ingenuity is sapped or faltered. No, because of government policies. Or families that sit around a dinner table and talk about losing their health insurance. Not because health insurance all of a sudden is difficult to provide, not profitable, or doctors don't want to practice the profession, no. Because of government policies. Families who go to the beach and run into barricades, that's B-A-R-R-Y, cades, you know, who go to national parks and find overlooks blocked off. Not because they're impossible to keep open, but out of pettiness and vindictiveness of a government whose leaders are offended that they are not going to get their way.
Yes.
So we're seeing all around us what happens when those principles of individual freedom, constitutionally limited government, and personal responsibility are cast aside. The result? Well, it's the same shortages, it's the same misery, perhaps not as bad as what we had lived through in the Soviet Union. But the laws of politics and the laws of economics are universal. Wherever and where, whenever and wherever in the world that government control has been tried, the result is invariably the same. And what I've always told people is, we've been very lucky in this country. We only know of this misery by reputation. In other words, from the words and suffering of others. From the stories that my parents can tell, from the stories that I can tell, from books that have been written, from suffering of others. We don't know it by experience. God help us if we learn their full extent by experience. So I'm running for Congress to prevent us from learning this by experience, because to me this is personal. Now, and one other thing. When I speak to audiences, when I tell those things, a lot of folks are dispirited and dejected. They feel like they're losing their country. They feel like perhaps, this transition from freedom into government control is irreversible, or perhaps it's gone too far. Let's conduct a very simple experiment. Who here supports the job that President Obama is doing? Anybody? Not a person? Wow, tough crowd. One person? Maybe? Okay, fair enough. Who opposes the job that President Obama is doing? Okay, well, now that we've got you all on the record, how many here are afraid to say no? Or how many people here are afraid to say they disapprove? Anybody? By the way, good evening, NSA, in case you're listening. But that's the beauty of America. What you're seeing around yourself is the American spirit at work. You couldn't sit in the Soviet Union and publicly say, Mr. Gorbachev or Mr. Brezhnev, or especially Mr. Stalin, Comrade Stalin, I oppose you. I disagree with what you're doing. Those people you would never see again. So we've got a tremendous opportunity to persuade, to argue, to tell our story, to tell exactly what freedom means to us, and earn the people's charter to govern. And that's exactly what I intend to do. I will paint the principles of freedom in the boldest of colors, because it is through freedom that we found every instance of prosperity in this country. And ultimately, the debate is going to come down to this very simple question. Who decides? Who decides every single question from the most important to the most personal in our lives? Is it we the people, or is it they the elites in government? And it's a very closely divided debate, because some people will insist that we cannot decide, that they ought to decide for us. They're experts, and they know what's best for us, so they ought to decide. And by the way, this is not a partisan conversation. There are plenty of Democrats who believe that, almost all of them, and there are plenty of Republicans who believe that as well. I'm running against two of them in this primary. But I think the vast majority of the American people, of all stripes, believe in freedom. They believe that we decide. I've spoken to a number of groups of, that are not just Republicans. It's impossible to do so if you want to win an election, especially in a district as closely divided as the South. And you'd be surprised. You will find a partisan Democrat who will stand up and say, I agree with you. I agree with you that we shouldn't be bailing out big banks. I agree with you that we shouldn't be going into wars where the United States has no business sending our men and women to die. I agree with you. The NSA shouldn't be listening to our most private of conversations and seizing our most intimate of records. When the conversation turns to freedom, it transcends partisan divides, it transcends race, it transcends religion. It transcends almost every single dividing line of American society. And I think that's what we're about to find out in this campaign. I'll never forget, my mom was telling the story of our apartment being searched in the Soviet Union. She looked at my brother, who was little, who was upset, and she said, really to all of us, to calm the whole family down, son, we're going to America in just a few days, and this will never happen there.
Not yet.
She'd never been to the United States of America before, not once in her life. As my dad said, they'd never been outside the country. But yet she knew that. She knew that because freedom means something. But what's the difference between a society like the Soviet Union and a society based on freedom like the United States? Well, it's something very simple. It's something that the founders recorded in the Declaration of Independence. It was a revolutionary concept. It was a concept that, for all of them, they were willing to be hanged for. Because that's, after all, what was awaiting if their effort had failed. It's the principle that had inspired them to take on the most powerful army and the most powerful navy in the history of humanity. And win. And that's a lot, if you think about it. And it's faith in a very simple principle. The rights that we have, the very basic rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, sounds familiar, right? They come from nature and nature's God. And governments are created among men to secure them through the consent of the governed. And if you think about that very important principle, it defines the entire notion of America. We're born with certain rights. Governments exist at our pleasure to secure them. But what's the difference between that and the Soviet Union? You know, the Soviet Union was a famously atheist society. You couldn't practice a religion. You would be shunned, fired, imprisoned, or worse yet, sent to a psychiatric asylum, because how could you, after all, a modern Soviet citizen in the 20th century believe in God? That's what, you know, those people in the Middle Ages did. But the Soviet society wasn't so much anti-God as they were anti-freedom. Because here's the dividing line. If rights don't come from God, if you expel God from the public square, rights come from government. And once rights come from government, those very basic rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, governments can issue and withdraw them at will to the privileged few. You know, my mom touched on that, you know, the healthcare system in the Soviet Union, where you waited in line to see a doctor, maybe in 3 weeks, maybe in 3 months, maybe in 3 days. You know, it was the same system that guaranteed everyone a free and universal health care. I admit. But when you picked up the phone to dial 911, we're all used to a very soothing, comforting voice on the other line. 911, what's your emergency? How can we help you? Well, you'd pick up the phone in the Soviet Union and call that number. You get a very cold voice saying, "Hello, how old is the patient?" And if the answer was too old, well, we're very sorry, or not, but the ambulance is just not coming. You know, when you talk about hospitals that were bereft of the basic supplies, like antibiotics, situation that I was born into, anesthesia, bedding, doctors, that's a consequence of government intrusion into life, and it's ultimately a consequence of government deciding to whom to extend what rights and when to withdraw them. And we can't have them in this country. But you know, there is something else. I remember other hospitals, too. They were well guarded by men that were very well armed. They're typically located by the Kremlin. I can assure you, although I've never been in one, that they had top-of-the-line anesthesia, top-of-the-line antibiotics, 1,000-thread Egyptian fine cotton bed. But they were reserved for, guess who? High-ranking government officials. Well, what are we seeing now, the debate that's erupting in Congress? Should Congress or should Congress not participate in the same healthcare system that they've created for the rest of us?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, they should.
Well, I think the answer, the resounding answer of the American people, regardless of party lines, regardless of race or creed or religion or anything else, is going to be yes, you shall live by the same laws to which you subject the rest of us.
Absolutely.
You know, and if I go to Congress, I will insist on that because I've already lived in a society that went by a different set of rules. And the result was abject misery for all involved. You know, Ronald Reagan said something very prophetic a number of times. He was talking about just how fleeting freedom was. You know, you all know that famous line that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. And he went on to say that in history, any generation that has lost the sight of freedom had never gone to know it again. And that's a very scary thought. But there's something else. He told a story of a Cuban refugee. Two of his friends met a Cuban refugee once. And the Cuban refugee told him his story of coming to freedom in America. Similar to mine, similar to my parents. And he was interrupted by one of the friends. And it happened to me many times. You know, I would tell my story and I'd get interrupted. And somebody would say, "My God, how lucky we are in America." But, you know, the Cuban interrupted right back and said, "Wait a second. You're the lucky ones? I'm the lucky one. Because I had some place to escape to." And it's very true. We are the lucky ones. My parents, my brother, my grandmother, and I, we are the lucky ones, because despite the abuse, despite the misery, despite the shortages, the lack of food, the lack of medicine, the surveillance, the constant notion of government control that pervades every inch of your life, down to when hot water is available in your little apartment, you knew that somewhere in the distance, there's that shining city on the hill. And someday, if you persevere, you will get there. But that shining city on the hill, that's us. And if we let that light get extinguished, there's no place else that we can find. So what Reagan told about the Cuban was very poignant. He said, you know, in that one sentence about him being the lucky one, the Cuban told us his entire story, Reagan said. He didn't have to go any farther. What he had meant is, this is freedom's last stand on earth. And if we lose it here, there's no place else that we can find. So, you know, I began my remarks by saying that I'm running for Congress because I cannot see any other purpose of my life than to dedicate it to the securing of freedom in this country. Because there's no place else to find it in the world. And you folks are here, and I'm very proud to be in your company, because you've dedicated your life to the same notion. That freedom is too important, too rare, too unimaginably good, abundant, and prosperous to simply let go. You know, these days when, you know, we're looking around ourselves and we're watching this very acrimonious debate with all the real consequences thereof, you know, the stagnant economy, the climbing unemployment, the rising discontent, the barricades, the shutdown government, Obamacare taking root all around us. You know, we have to understand something. These are very important days, but they're not dark days. Churchill, obviously, as you know, led the United Kingdom through a very, very, very difficult, poignant, and ultimately important period in the history of that nation, World War II. I mean, if you think about it, in the 40s, Churchill was running England, which was a very small island of freedom, in the sea of what was by then overtaken by the darkness and blackness of German despotism and tyranny. All around them, they were an island, but they were surrounded. They had German Navy massing off the coast of France, German Air Force routinely conducting missions over London, bombing and killing civilians, virtually unmolested by the Royal Air Force. So Churchill visited Harrow, his old school, to give the students a pep talk, because, you know, they were also subjected to bombings, they were also subjected to hiding in the catacombs and waiting out the raids and not knowing whether the school would survive or not. And in his honor, they changed a stanza in the school alma mater song. And Churchill said these words that I think are very poignant. He said, you know, I noticed that you've changed a stanza in the alma mater. It now reads, in darker days no less we praise. He says, I'd like to offer a change. He says, I don't like this notion of darker days. I'd like to offer this change. In sterner days no less we praise. He says, these are not dark days. These are stern days. These are very important days, but ultimately this is not where he used the finest hour point, but he said these are the most important days of our empire. And so I believe is the case with America. These are not dark days. They're challenging days. They're stern days. But they're ultimately very important days. We're very lucky, because history walks very closely with us as we encounter every bump in the road in public policy. History watches every decision we make very closely, because ultimately it's going to fall to our generation whether or not to pass on those values that inspired my parents to persevere through every insult that the communist regime threw their way. The same values that inspired countless, countless Americans in the greatest generation to take on the two most powerful armies in the world. The same values that inspired a band of patriots to take on England. Limited government, individual freedom, personal responsibility, the values of the Tea Party, whether or not those values are passed along to the next generation. And ultimately, history will record very closely whether or not that next generation knows the same freedom that I and my brother and my parents found here in America. And it comes down to that very simple question. Who decides? Do we the people decide our affairs, or do the elites and government decide our affairs? My point throughout my campaign is going to be that we decide. It's not an incident that the Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." It is unique in all the constitutions of the world. Every single constitution in the world grants rights from government to the people. The government decides. In our Constitution, we the people grant to government those powers that we see fit in order for the government to preserve and protect those rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's the character of our nation that we have to preserve. Because if we don't, we will lose freedom and we'll never find it anyplace else. Now, I don't think that's our destiny. I think our destiny is freedom. And I think we are very fortunate in that history has selected our generation to carry out that destiny. And I can't be more proud and more honored than to be in your company, because ultimately it will be together that we restore freedom as the future of our nation, as the cornerstone of its public policy, and ultimately secure that destiny. You know, my mom mentioned the story of my grandparents, one of whom is still alive, my grandmother, two of whom have since passed on. You know, they came here as my life was just beginning. They were in their late 70s and early 80s. They spent their whole lives, whole entire lives, from childhood to their late 70s when they first came here, living in utter despotism, living through Stalin and Khrushchev and Brezhnev, and knowing every single excess of the tyrannical regime, and wondering if perhaps they or their friends might get taken away in the dead of night, never to be seen again. But they came here inspired to become Americans. That's the amazing draw of freedom. So, despite the names that the Tea Party gets called, despite the shrill rhetoric on the left, which is, by the way, getting more and more shrill by the minute, and it means exactly two things. One, they're losing, and two, they know they're losing.
Right.
Stand proud, stand for freedom, and ultimately our destiny will be fulfilled to pass on that freedom to the next generation, to those who are yet to come to these shores, to those who will be coming to these shores for as long as tyranny exists throughout the world, to inspire folks to seek out freedom. So thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for all of the support that you've shown me so far. Thank you for having me here today. And ultimately, thank you for joining me in this fight for freedom.
Thank you, Igor. I'm not used to this microphone. Is it on?
Yes.
Over there by Art Ross, you want to lift up those two clipboards? The one has Igor's biography, and then also if you want to get on his email list, during the break you can sign it, put your email address, and that way if you want to get more information or become more involved in his campaign, those are the two places you need to sign it right there. Okay? And also, Mark McLaughlin knew that today was Igor's family's anniversary, so Art, do you have that cake?
Thank you so very much. Thank you so very much.
It's our pleasure.
Well, no, it's entirely my pleasure to share this moment with you. I couldn't have imagined better company.
19 years in America.
The only question is, do I duck your questions first or second?
You better blow out the candle.
Wow. Thank you, folks, very, very much. I'm happy to take some questions. You know, I realize that this is much better spent without me lecturing you and rather you asking questions and having a discussion. So, Eric.
Well, you know, I appreciate all of your idealism, but you just got here. Wouldn't it be better to elect someone like Tommy, who's been here a long time? he's so much better connected. So, what's your answer to that?
Does the laughter qualify? Look, Eric, the point is, I don't even know how to say it without breaking into laugh. The whole reason is I came here to find freedom. Every vote that Congressman Baer has cast has taken a piece out of that freedom, piece by piece.
That's right.
I don't think we can keep going down that road anymore, because there's no place for us to flee from his bad votes. We've got two options. A, expel folks who vote like him, whichever party they may affiliate themselves with, or B, look for another place to live in freedom. But since B is impossible, and since we love America too much, I think it's option A.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. How about something more challenging? Yes?
Okay, in the state of California, right, when our legislature doesn't pass the budget on time, they don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see that happen up in Washington.
Yeah.
Or, I got a better idea. It's new. I don't think it's ever
maybe
been proposed. So let's propose a whole new idea here. It's never been broached before. How about we actually elect people who will pass a budget? I mean, don't forget. You know, we can't confuse that line between elected representatives and tyrants. Tyrants, you can fight against and deprive them of salary and fine them, etc. Because Lord knows we can't get rid of them, so at least we're going to punish them. These are folks that you and I can get rid of. So by God, let's. You know, it's gotten to the point in the history of our nation where we have to secure freedom. I don't care what party the individual who votes against freedom affiliates himself or herself with. Give them a hug, pat them on the back if they've been nice, and send them packing, because ultimately we can't afford to lose freedom. But I agree. Look, you know, Congress has to live by the laws that it makes. But my first preference is to actually for the people to exercise their franchise and send folks who will believe it when they say that they will swear to uphold the Constitution. So, you know, my point is, if I'm lucky enough to be elected, I will swear to uphold, preserve, and protect the Constitution just like anybody else. I will mean it. I hope to be in the company of 434 others who will mean it.
Term limit.
Well, it's an interesting subject. You know, I just signed a pledge to support no more than 2 terms in the Senate, no more than 3 terms in the House. On the one hand, I look at California and I wonder if term limits are the best of ideas. Because ever since term limits have gotten imposed on the legislature in California, things have not exactly gotten better. They've gotten worse.
Yeah.
But I look at Congress and I look at the inexhaustible source of talent in the nation. And I just wonder if we can't send folks to Congress who are intelligent, who understand freedom, who will fight for freedom without becoming entrenched. You know, let me tell you something. I never thought 19 years ago that I'd be running for Congress. I'll tell you, 10 years ago, 6 years ago, even 5 years ago, I didn't think that I'd be running for Congress today. But our nation has gotten so far down the road to serfdom that I have to go and tell my story. But here's the thing. It's not a career. You don't make a career out of it. You know, regardless of whether term limits will be passed, once we have successfully turned the corner and we're no longer on that road to serfdom, I ought to go find something better to do, because my mission in Congress will have been fulfilled. So that's why I ultimately signed the term limit pledge, because this is not a career that spans decades upon decades. For some it may be, you know, for Churchill it was. For Tom McClintock it is, because he's a great spokesman for freedom. But ultimately, you know, we have too many folks who have become too deeply entrenched, accountable to no one, who forget who sent them to Congress to begin with, who can get away with keeping a straight face and saying, well, you know, rules and regulations that we make are, well, they're for thee and not for me. You know, term limits are not a perfect solution, but I think they'll get those folks out of Congress and hopefully replace them with fresher blood from time to time. So.
I'd like to add to that.
Yeah.
I'm against term limits myself. As long as the fair political practices is working properly, if a member is doing his job and his constituents keep voting him in, then he's doing a good job. He should stay on the job. We've had a lot of good guys that get turned out, and a lot of history is lost. You know, it takes these guys a lot of years just to learn the ropes how to get legislation put through. You know, and when you got freshmen coming in all the time, just bogs the system down.
You know, I'm not ashamed to say that I'll keep an open mind. You know, you don't go to Congress pretending to be all-knowing. I can tell you, I know the difference between freedom and tyranny, and, you know, I'll keep an open line of term limits. I see both sides to the issue. But I can also see a lot of folks like Nancy Pelosi, like Peter King. I mean, there are Republicans and Democrats of the same stripe. Nobody dares to run against them because they're terrified of them. So term limits are an imperfect solution to get rid of them, but they'll accomplish that task. So, like I said, but I'm certainly willing to keep an open mind. Yes, ma'am.
The question I have was,
yes.
you got onto it at the end, is how the Republicans are fighting against one another. And, you know, it just, I mean, how can that kind of situation be changed?
Well, very simply. So let me put it to you this way. I've heard so many times from folks how terrible the climate is in D.C., you know, that Republicans don't get along with Republicans, Democrats don't get along with Democrats, or with Republicans, and certainly not with themselves. I remember this one meeting in the aftermath of the Syria fiasco, when the president, remember, kept drawing all these red lines and letting Assad walk all over them, and then begging Putin, the dictator of Russia, to save his sorry butt. Can you imagine Reagan ever doing that, by the way?
No.
My God, can you imagine Reagan going to Gorbachev saying, help! But, you know, it's the same guy who sends, and Rand Paul has done the math on this, who sends more people to secure the World War II memorial from World War II veterans than to secure the embassy in Benghazi from terrorists.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you imagine? But in the aftermath of that, there's a group in Washington called the Liberty Caucus. It's run by Rand Paul and Justin Amash. And it's a group of liberty-minded folks who get together to talk about public policy from a liberty perspective. But in the aftermath of the Syrian situation, that meeting was brimming with members, Republicans and Democrats. None of that unease was hanging in the air. You know, oh, well, these are Republicans, these are Democrats on the other side. People were excited, people were energized because they were brought there by freedom. So I see increasingly the dividing line throughout the country is not Republican or Democrat. It's freedom versus authoritarianism, freedom versus statism. So the reasons there are some Republicans who don't get along with others is very simple. Some believe in freedom, some things we decide. Others believe in statism, the government decides. I mean, that's how this primary is going to transpire. Republicans are going to disagree. But again, the dividing line is freedom. And ultimately, I think the winning coalition in this district in the general election will be that of freedom. It will consist of a great many Republicans. It will consist of a great many independents. And it will consist of Democrats who also believe in freedom. But that's the dividing line. So what to do about that acrimony? Elect Republicans who believe in freedom. I mean, look, let's face it. My main opponent is a guy who served in Congress. Here's a former congressman. He's acquired a voting record. His name is Doug Osie. But that name may ring a bell to you because this is an individual who voted with the Democrats to shrink tax cuts, voted for every conceivable earmark, including investigating something like sexual arousal in older men and Asian masseuses and prostitutes in San Francisco, and on and on and on, who voted against cutting government spending by 1%, and then on the same day voted against cutting government spending by 1/3 of 1%. So Republicans are going to disagree on issues like this, but again, the dividing line is freedom, so it's natural. Just the solution is send more Republicans who believe in freedom, and there won't be acrimony.
I have firsthand knowledge that the last election, there was a lot of fraud in Sacramento County, and it had a particular party. It went on for over a year. Real harassments of some of our Republican candidates, no names. And I feel that if you're going to be running, you will be hitting against the same type of fraud and difficulties.
I don't
doubt
it.
You know
for a
those?
Second.
I don't know, but I'm not mentioning any names. Maybe I can talk to you later. But my concern is for you and your campaign. They stop at nothing to win, and they will cheat and lie and steal votes. And that's exactly what happened to Sacramento County.
When they feel the heat, they see the light. Heard that before? famous expression, but here's the point. Look, it's up to us, the citizens, to secure the franchise. I mean, again, who's the sovereign in this country?
We are.
Bingo. So when the law is violated, and the government won't do anything to help, the government has hired help. We are the sovereigns. So when the government fails in its duty, whatever it may be, the obligation is on the people to secure those rights. So I take it very seriously. I'll tell you, my first experience with voter fraud, my old boss, Tom McClintock, ran for controller in 2002. You guys remember that election? I remember it because it was the closest, and still is, the closest in California's history. He lost by 16,683 votes, but who's counting, out of 7.5 million. So roughly 18/100 of 1%, incredibly, razor small margin. Because I was new, they sent me to San Francisco to observe the vote count. I can only imagine that's why. So there I am. I was, what was I, 21, 22 at the time. And my job was to stand over a registrar of voters employee who was going through absentee ballots and pulling some out to be counted and disqualifying others. So she goes very fast, takes one, scans it or puts the name on the computer and goes on to the next. Pulls out this one where, it struck me that, the signature line was done in block letters. And puts the name into the computer, and the computer says, deceased. So you know what she does next? Of course, you think, well, she takes it and puts it aside to be disqualified. No, she takes it and she puts it on the file to be counted. And I tap her on the shoulder and I say, ma'am, I'm sorry, but your computer says deceased. Oh, well, that's just a mistake. See, he signed the envelope.
Oh, my God.
So that's how blatant they are. But you see, you signed the envelope. No, ma'am, I insist you set that envelope aside. So, you have to get the precinct judge involved ultimately to get the envelope set aside. But that's what it takes. So I'm very mindful of it. We've encountered it before. I worked on Tom's 2008 campaign that he won by 1,800 votes out of 350,000 cast. He's obviously blessed with razor-thin election margins. Not anymore. Last election, 90,000 votes. But here's the thing. We encountered the same thing in Nevada County. People registered to vote at Lowe's. I mean, I know people that work long hours, but I don't think that qualifies you to register to vote there. So, again, the thing is to be ever vigilant, and that role belongs to us, the people, because government has absolutely failed in that role. We don't require voter ID in California. We should, but we don't. We don't verify the eligibility of an individual to register to vote other than the signature on the form. We should, but we don't. So what do we do? Well, we're going to put an observer at every single precinct. We conducted an experiment. Having gone through this encounter with voter fraud in 2008, I ran an effort where we put a observer, most of them actually was run by the Tea Party. We put a Tea Party observer at just about every single precinct in Nevada County. You know how many instances of fraud we had reported? Precisely zero.
We heard
a lot of complaints such as, oh my God, there are observers there. How dare they come and observe? We can't do what we're planning on. But we got precisely zero instances, precisely zero complaints. Like I said, absentee ballots, you can't verify each and every one. But certainly by posting a volunteer to observe the count and to observe the processes at every single precinct, it goes a long way towards combating it. And that's certainly in the works. So let me get back to you. I think we've had a couple. Yes.
I'd like to know what your take on immigration. They're talking about passing an immigration law, but my thought is you want to close those borders first. You don't need to do anything except close the borders before you do anything.
Here's the thing. Look, I'm living, breathing, proud, patriotic American proof that our legal immigration system works and works well. So why mess with it?
Yeah.
I can tell you, if you ask my parents, if you ask my grandmother, say, what do you think of illegal immigration? They'll get very upset. They'll say, well, it's an insult to us. Because despite the tyranny that we've encountered, despite all the horrors that we've lived through, we had enough respect for the United States of America, for our new home, to observe the law. But let me put it to you this way. There's obviously a great debate about what to do. And my view on it was greatly simplified by an encounter I had with a gentleman, not too far from here, actually, who married a girl from Guadalajara. And she came here with a green card. She became an American and came here. She has a sister out there in Guadalajara. The sister's a small business owner. She's terrified out of her wits because the drug gangs won't let her run her business. If she wants to come to America and be an American and not be on public assistance, she wants to come and run a small business and be one of us and be free. Well, you know what happened? That man and his wife, they went to the consulate. They filled out all the forms for family reunification. The consulate finally said, well, great. She's welcome to come. You're all set. It'll be 16 years. Well, pray tell, why is it 16 years? Why is it not 16 months or 16 days, for that matter? If somebody wants to come here, not be on public assistance, be a small business owner, and take every advantage of free, why is it 16 months? And worse yet, why is nobody in the Republican Party making that case for legal immigration? I mean, the opportunity here is tremendous. Listen to the left. The left wants to champion illegal immigration. They want to grant amnesty. But let's pause and think here for a second. There are roughly, what would you say, 13 million illegal immigrants in the country. Let's say amnesty is passed and signed into law. How many are there the next day?
20,000.
Zero. No, there's zero. They've all been legalized. But the following day, there are some. And a month later, there's more. And 15 years later, guess what? We're looking at 13 more million. And we're back to square one. And let's look at something else. You know, the Democrats, the left... Yeah, well, here's the thing. The Democrats love to talk about the plight of the illegal aliens, how terrible life is for them to lurk in the shadows of society. And I agree, it's not a life I would wish upon anybody. We came here. We came here legally. We became Americans. We learned English. We learned American culture. We were proud to call ourselves American. We took the citizenship exam. We passed it. We learned the history, the traditions, and the founding values of this country. As a result, we prospered. That's what legal immigration is all about. It's assimilation. Illegal immigration is utterly inconsistent with assimilation. So let the Democrats, let the left champion illegal immigration. Let us champion legal immigration. But let's streamline the system. There is no need for the immigration system to resemble that joke that Ronald Reagan used to tell about the Soviet Union. When a fellow walks in to buy a car with all his forms stamped in triplicate, and the bureaucrat says, congratulations, comrade, you're qualified. You can come back here and pick up your car in 10 years. And the guy says, oh, 10 years, great. Noted, I'll be right here in 10 years. Now tell me, comrade, morning or afternoon? And the bureaucrat is angry. He says, well, what does it matter, morning or afternoon? It's in 10 years. The guy says, well, you see, the plumber, he's coming in the morning. But somebody needs to stand up and say that there's no need for our immigration system to resemble that anecdote. If somebody's willing to come here and say that they're not going to be on public assistance, that they want to become an American and be one of us, let's welcome them with open arms. And people will rally to our cause, because the other side will be championing living in the dark of society, in the margins, hiding, hoping all the while that maybe another amnesty will come their way. You tell me who wins that public debate. Yes, sir.
I think the real elephant in the room, I'd like to hear your ideas on it, is our crushing debt. You know, for every dollar we spend, we've got to borrow like 45 cents. We can't do that. You can't do that. My family can't do that. And the stuff I read, periodicals and stuff, say this thing is going to have a flat in a couple of years, and then it's just going to skyrocket. And we will be, our freedom will be an absolute slave to that. How do we get started on that?
Well, so I've got some good news. We're never going to get to that point when it balloons, because we'll either have a sovereign debt crisis by then and the economy will collapse, or China will simply stop lending. But here's a serious, all levity aside, it's a serious question. And this is a point where we have to admit some very uncomfortable truths. Government has made promises to the American people that it cannot keep.
Right.
You know, back when I was working for Tom McClintock, his point was, well, that can't be. Government made a promise. Government has to live up to that promise. It's this basic honor of the social compact. So, you know, all the obligations under Social Security, we have to pay. We can reform the system, but we have to pay the existing obligations. You know, Medicare, we have to fulfill the promises that we've made. The answer is we're in the numbers. We can shut down the government completely, dispose of every asset of the United States of America, completely liquidate the nation, and still not meet the obligations. So the answer is very simple. Government has made promises it cannot keep. And if we don't reform those drivers of our debt, and do so very urgently, we're going to come up with, right against the sovereign debt crisis. Now, I've lived through one. My parents have lived through one in the Soviet Union when the country collapsed. We saw a sovereign debt crisis. It is hell on earth. It is not pretty. It is not something that we ought to sit by and watch our country wander its way into. There's certainly a great deal of debate, acrimony, and even disagreement on the Republican side. So I'll say, well, these are heartless reforms. You know, the Democrats are portraying Paul Ryan, whose plan is good, but it's a good start. It's pushing grandma off a cliff. And all the while, we're not hearing anything out of the Republican leadership other than timid excuses and explanations. The very simple point that they have to make is anytime somebody says, well, you know, leave Medicare alone, is what they're really saying is, let Medicare collapse in just a few years, as Barack Obama's own Medicare actuary has admitted. So that's the case that we have to make. But again, the solution is very simple. We've got a plan that works. It's a start. You know, you have to, in essence, turn Medicare into a premium support program that allows seniors to select a plan of your choice that they can, or their choice rather, that they can dispose of when they see fit if it doesn't suit their needs. Means testing to be sure that we're not providing Medicare to, you know, folks who, quite frankly, don't need it. But in reality, it takes a lot of courage to stand up and say, look, the system as it is right now is destined to collapse. We have to start from scratch. We have to offer folks for my age the ability to invest their own funds and spend their retirement from the fruits of their own labor and from the fruits of their own investments.
You can't even get a politician to discuss it.
Then fire that politician. Who does he work for?
Exactly.
Then fire that politician. That's what the Tea Party is all about, and ultimately that's what the American people are going to have to do if we're going to succeed in keeping this country free. Bankrupt nations don't stay nations very long. History is full of examples of this. And these are going to be some very uncomfortable and acrimonious discussions that we have to have. But the facts are on our side. They're indisputable. They're very stubborn, as Reagan used to say. And ultimately, the American people will rally to us if we communicate them clearly, if we communicate them like we believe in them, and if we have a solution. And we do have a solution. Let me tell you about, you know, one idea that that I worked on before I left to run this campaign. You know, the Social Security system is so far solvent, but its long-term future is very much in debt. We went through this period where, you know, government offered, well, you know, we'll cut your payroll tax, and then we'll just simply backfill the Social Security obligation through the general from the Treasury. Really. We proposed a different idea. We said, how about we cut the payroll tax, but then we let folks invest that portion of the payroll tax into a retirement account and simply elect to get Social Security a few years later. We just ran the numbers through the Social Security actuary right before I left. Turns out not only do the numbers pass the muster, they improve the condition of Social Security for the next 75 years. Again, freedom works. All that it takes is somebody with belief in freedom who's willing to stand up and stake their career on it. Because let's face it, you know, if we succeed, we'll save the country. And if we fail, then we don't deserve to have a career or, you know, any engagement in public policy. There's a very poignant story that I read about Churchill. In the worst horrors of the raids on London, his aide came across a prayer that was said at the Siege of Gibraltar hundreds of years before. And it's very simple, and I've committed it to memory because it's a very poignant prayer, and it's also it's visionary, and it's very useful in times like these. You know, when solutions are difficult, when the future is uncertain, but a fight for freedom is necessary. The prayer is very simple. It says, fear not the result, for either thy end shall be an enviable and a majestic one, or God shall preserve our reign upon the waters. Let's take it to heart, because it means something very important. Do your best, stand for freedom, paint it in the boldest of colors, and if you succeed, my God, history will remember you well. But if you don't, you will have tried your best. And that's what's lacking so much in the political class and that class of elites in Washington, D.C. They'd rather shy away from a debate only to win the next election. But tell me, what good are they? Yes, turn the back.
Maybe you touched on this earlier, but what about our veterans in view of what happened in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, again, you know, this is a question of courage, and this is ultimately a question of the people standing up to challenge tyranny that we see in government. I mean, look, we faced with, fighting over whether or not we should extend benefits to, you know, to those who gave their lives for our country. You know, we really ought to have a debate over whether or not the veterans of World War II who are dying at an enormous rate can have access to the World War II Memorial. This is not a debate. This is a teachable moment for the American Republic. And this is, I think, a moment when the American public will awaken and join our side for freedom, regardless of their party affiliation or really who they voted for in the last election. So we look at the events in Washington. It's an incredible teachable moment for the American Republic. Let's perceive it as such. But let's be sure that we do our part in teaching those to whom we have access about what's going on. All we need to do is point to what's going on. The people are smart enough to draw their own conclusions. So there are no excuses except for to say, well, this is government control at its finest. This is a petulant, vindictive, and petty, I hate to use the word leader for this person, excuse for a leader that our nation has seen. And it's on full display. And the great thing is we've got an election coming up, and the American people, I think, will make a very informed decision. Well, folks, thank you very, very much. You've been very kind. If you'll suffer me one more minute, I wanted to introduce somebody else in the audience. Manuel Martin is here. He's a friend of mine who's running for state assembly. And quite frankly, not state assembly.